Kreisky-Forum Talks, der Podcast zur Stunde.
I would like to thank Anita Eichinger from the director of the Vienna Library and the responsible person for the Wiener Vorlesung for the Vienna Lectures. Thank you very, very much. This is our first cooperation, and thank you for inviting us to be part of the very famous Wiener Vorlesungen. And we are very, very happy to start this cooperation with two fabulous young women. I think it is also a signal that we wanted to send out that two brilliant young economists should have the center stage at the first Vienna Vorlesungen that we do together. So thank you very much, Raisi and Rosie, for accepting the invitation. And I hope you enjoy the evening.
I also want to say thank you for this really lovely invitation. I didn't know I was inaugurating this event with Rosie, this cooperation, so it's an even bigger honor for me. I don't want to lose too much time. Actually, I just want to introduce Rosie Collington, who has traveled here from London to present and discuss her book that she co-authored with Mariana Mazzucato, The Big Con. Rosie Collington is a political economist at the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose at the University College London. So thank you, Rosie, for making the trip over here. We're really excited to hear about your work, and I look forward to the discussion.
Well, thank you all so much for coming. Thank you so much to the Kreisky Forum. It is a huge honor to be here. As you can imagine, I've been a follower of Bruno Kreisky's work and life, and we've talked a little bit about that today, and also to the Vienna Lectures. It's, again, amazing to be here. It seems like a wonderful event, and also to be doing it with Rezi, whose work I have been following for a very long time, and who I've met. I think we were both involved in the Institute for New Economic Thinking Young Scholars Initiative for many years a while ago. So it is great now to be here together and joining you. But I'm going to begin talking about this book that I have co-authored with Mariana Mazzucato, whose work I'm sure many of you will be familiar with. She is one of my PhD supervisors. I actually met Mariana at an event organized by the Institute for New Economic Thinking Young Scholars Initiative, and then I joined her for my PhD. And I had been researching outsourcing in the UK public health system, in the UK National Health Service, for many years, working in public policy before I went back to university to study a master's in political economy and then subsequently to do my PhD. During that time when I was working in public policy in the UK, I also had the pleasure of working for one of the big four accounting consultancies that we discuss in the book. I'm not going to name them here, but it was this experience that got me really interested in the role that this sector plays in our economies. Because the team that I was working with, and actually one question that I always like to ask, because it varies so much from discussion to discussion, are there any consultants in the room? Yeah. Hey, great. Nice to meet you. Are there any students who are interested in becoming consultants? Okay. Hi. Nice to meet you too. So I was a student and I was very interested in becoming a consultant. And so I was very excited to have this opportunity to work with this team in one of my first jobs from one of the big four companies. And we were tasked with helping to develop a strategy for innovation in cardiovascular disease innovation research, an innovation strategy for cardiovascular disease research in the UK health system. It was a super interesting project, and it became very clear that none of us in this immediate team that was tasked with doing this work really had any idea what we were doing. Now, if I tell you I was 23 at this time and I had a background as a political scientist, that probably doesn't come as a surprise that I didn't really know what I was doing. It's probably more surprising, though, that this team of otherwise completely brilliant, super intelligent, high-flying, you know, young women who I was in a team with doing this project with also had no idea what they were doing. That was a big surprise to me because that's not what I imagined this sector to be like. Now, of course, one example, one experience is not necessarily representative of the wider sector, right? But it stayed with me. And so as when I went back to university, when I started researching how governments try to develop capabilities to get stuff done, what role outsourcing and these reforms that we have in different public sector configurations, different public sector ministries, what role these different structures play in the ability to implement or realize or deliver public policy, I became more interested because, you know, some studies were emerging that showed, for example, in the NHS, that the increased use of management consultants in the NHS in the United Kingdom had not led to an increase in in productivity, which is kind of the main reason why they are often contracted, or why one of the reasons that we're told they are contracted, and had not, or in some cases, had even undermined the effectiveness of the organizations and had ended up costing a lot of money. So this was while I was doing my studies. And I was doing lots of this research. And Mariana, if you're familiar with her work over many years, you'll know that she's also been researching and writing about the state and the role of government, both historically and today, and the ways that governments are structured, and the different ways that these might affect the ability of governments to deliver their missions or their goals, the things that they want to do, the things that citizens want them to do. And then the pandemic hit while I was starting my PhD. And all of a sudden, these companies that I had been researching since I had worked for one of them, and that I was planning to continue researching as part of my PhD, these companies that Mariana had also been writing about when she wrote about mission economy, when she wrote the book Mission Economy, she wrote about outsourcing in the National Health Service as well. All of a sudden, in the UK and in many other countries across Europe, these companies were on the front pages of national newspapers, both tabloids, but also, you know, some more respectable newspapers across Europe, for the extent of outsourcing that governments had used them for. And the huge contracts, the huge sum of money that had been handed over to them in the process of developing and delivering services in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. So in the UK, the last kind of good estimate, and I'll tell you a little bit about why data on kind of how much money governments spend on these companies and their revenue is pretty challenging, getting accurate data. I'll tell you a little bit about that shortly. But the best estimate we have, or we had in 2021 when the final calculations were made, was in the UK that £700 million had been spent on management consulting companies to develop and deliver services in response to COVID-19 in the UK. Now, the UK government spent in 2022 a total of £2.8 billion, which was an increase of 75% from 2019. So this was kind of growing massively in the UK. So at the outset of the pandemic, the UK government chucked a lot of money at some of the biggest companies in this sector, including Deloitte, which was earning at £1.1 million per day from its contracts for test and trace services. An inquiry by the Test and Trace program was the UK's epidemiological contact tracing program. So it included the apps that everyone had on their phones, but it was also what was happening in the or what was being done in the health ministry, for example, to help monitor the spread of COVID-19. An inquiry by the Parliamentary Public Accounts Committee, which is a parliamentary group made up of cross-party MPs, found that this programme had been overly reliant on expensive contractors and temporary staff, I'm quoting there, and that it had not achieved its main objective to help break chains of COVID-19 transmission and enable people to return to a more normal way of life. So this was quite damning. And you know, we, at that point, as a UK citizen, I'd come to accept that perhaps, you know, we'd become pretty bad at getting things right. But actually, this was not just a UK phenomenon. Across Europe, we saw an increase in spending in management consultancies across many governments in Europe during the COVID-19 pandemic, including in France. I don't know if there are any followers of French politics or French political scientists, French citizens here. If so, you will know that the French public sector, the French public administration, has historically prided itself on its meritocracy and its and prided itself on how effective and efficient the public sector is, how good the civil servants are. And it has historically not outsourced in the way that the UK government or the US government, the Australian governments have. If you've been following French politics over the past couple years, you will also know that Le Scandale McKinsey, and I apologise for my French, has been plaguing Macron now for a few years. At the beginning of 2021, when all governments across Europe were implementing and rolling out vaccination programmes, commentators started asking why the French government or why the French population was seemingly unvaccinated and was lagging far behind counterparts in Germany and Spain. Members of the government, the rapporteurs who are responsible for holding different parts of the government to account, started to look into how the government was spending money, how it was organizing its implementation of these programs, and lo and behold, found that the government was also spending a lot of money on these consulting companies. In March 22, the French Senate released a report following a very long inquiry that found that central government ministries in France had spent almost 900 million euros on consulting fees in 2021, which was double what had been spent in 2018. Now, at the same time, we were also learning about the ways that these companies were being involved or becoming involved in the development of net zero strategies around the world. And perhaps most famously during this time, or a case that became well known during this time, was the Australian government's contracting of McKinsey to help develop its national net zero or long-term emissions reduction plan, it was called. So McKinsey received a $6 million Australian dollars contract to help develop this strategy. And it was published at the Conference of Parties in 2022 or 2021. And it was subsequently found, commentators and climate analysts subsequently found that it was full of holes, that the strategy would not get Australia to net zero, even if it was fully implemented by 2050, which was Australia's own deadline. And to the extent that it could, to the 80% of the extent that it could, it was very reliant on the development of technologies that did not exist yet. So it was actually of a kind of indexing of a ranking of 60 different climate strategies, this net zero plan was ranked 60th out of 60. So all of this is to say that the list of scandals that we started to find out about in 2020 and 2021 started to get quite long. There are others that we talk about in the book, and I can also point you to some other excellent works of investigative journalism that came out during the process of writing the book, and books that came out around the same time ours did as well, that detail some of these scandals. Including the state capture scandal in South Africa, which readers of the Financial Times and other newspapers will certainly be familiar with. I won't go into too much detail here. Or the role that McKinsey played in the restructuring of debt in Puerto Rico, for example. But we wanted to delve beneath the surface. As an economist and a political economist, we wanted to try to understand what, if anything, do these scandals, do these kind of headline-grabbing cases tell us about transformations in the economy and this so-called crisis of capitalism that we're hearing so much about. So we began this research project, or we continued this research project, and this research that we've been doing over some years, with five questions. One, why do so many governments outsource critical activities to consulting companies? Why has the market for consulting companies grown so much in recent decades? 3, what do consultants do? And what role does the consulting industry play in the economy overall? 4, why do so many well-meaning and smart graduates choose to work for these companies? And that sounds like a silly question, but actually looking at why people want to work for a sector and what drives them and how that company presents itself to groups of people who it could recruit is very telling, as we discovered and wrote about in the book. And finally, what might all of this tell us, if anything, about contemporary capitalism? So I'll just tell you a little bit more. I've been talking about these companies so far in very kind of abstract terms, so I'll just tell you a little bit about the companies that we focus on in the book. We use the term the consulting industry. It's on the cover, and we use it throughout the book. But as we also detail, defining this sector is very challenging because there is no agreed upon, no regulated definition of consultant or consulting company. You can all go home today. Those of you who are not consultants, you are also welcome to go home today and update your LinkedIn bio to say that you are a consultant, and no one will tell you off. You are very welcome to do that. So we focus in the book on what are called the big three and the big four. The big three are companies that are sometimes referred to as strategy consulting companies, and that's McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, and Bain & Company. And the big four are companies that you might know as accounting firms, so that's KPMG, PwC, Ernst & Young, and Deloitte. But actually, they make most of their money from advisory services. Auditing continues to be, and has been since the 1990s, a very low margin kind of service area for these companies. So they are, you know, we call them accounting consultancies in the book because we should understand them as consultancies first and foremost. These companies have various different origins that we talk about in the book. There are a number of other different types of consultancies that we touch on in the book, including, for example, IT consultancies like IBM and Cisco. And many of these companies bid on the same types of contracts as the big three and the big four companies. We also, in the book, talk about outsourcing companies or outsourcing consultancies. And I didn't realize how controversial this would be, actually, because, you know, sometimes when you're in academia, terms get used and things become normalized, including the fact that everyone who researches consultancies refers to the outsourcing generation of consultancies, which includes, for example, Serco, Sodexo, Atos, these companies that many people think of as providing or delivering public services. Now, we include them in our analysis because, again, they are bidding on many of the same contracts that the big three and the big four are also bidding on. They are not primarily in the business of directly delivering public services often, but of managing contracts and often the subcontracting process on behalf of governments. So when Carillion collapsed, which was one of these big outsourcing public services and construction outsourcing companies, collapsed in 2018, in the UK, it was outsourcing, it was subcontracting 80% of the contracts that it had received or that it was responsible for delivering. So in this way, they are management, that they are in the business of management as opposed to in public services delivery. Now, of course, some of you who are consultants might be working for a company that doesn't fit any of these categories. There are also, most people who work as consultants actually are not working for the big three and the big four, even though in terms of revenue, the big three and the big four and some of the larger IT consultancies dominate the market. Most people work for what are known as boutique consultancies. This is, again, the industry term. And so that would include smaller firms that often operate within a market niche like climate consulting or perhaps provide services for a specific company like the NHS or a particular ministry in government, or provide digital services for local governments or something like this. Now, we don't focus on these companies in the book. We do show, however, that some of the same dynamics that we can see that underpin the behavior and activities of some of the larger companies can also become embedded in these smaller companies, which can become reliant on the pursuit of kind of further contracts for their very existence in ways that can undermine any kind of public value claims that they may have. And indeed, many of the very successful smaller specialist boutique consultancies become acquired by the larger companies. That's part of how they operate and grow. So I mentioned something about the growth of these companies during the pandemic. Now, the pandemic was, in many ways, very beneficial for the scale and scope, or it became a boon for many of these companies. But it wasn't an anomaly in the sense that actually these companies had been growing and this sector had been growing. The market for consulting services had been growing very largely over a few decades. So in 1999, management consulting revenues were estimated to be worth around $100 million globally. And by 2021, the estimates brought it close to $1 trillion, or some brought it to $700 billion globally, and some brought it up to $1 trillion dollars globally. So that's a huge increase. We can see this also within individual countries. I was looking into some of the databases that I have access to through my research, and was looking at this in Austria. And I think even between 2012 and 2018, so before the pandemic, the market for consulting services here was growing by 6.5% per annum every year. So, you know, way above growth of GDP. There was hugely increased demand in strategy services. So McKinsey and Boston Consulting Group and other companies that pitch themselves as offering strategy services have been some of the main beneficiaries of this. These companies operate around the world. The Big Four have offices in 130 countries and employ around 400,000 people. Though this is by no means kind of equally distributed. 96% of revenues come from North America and Europe, and 70% of their fees worldwide are generated by just 5 countries. So that's the US, Canada, UK, France, Germany. Though, again, as I said, the fastest growing, or another thing to mention is that the fastest growing markets are in Africa and Asia, or in developing countries in these areas. Now, I touched upon the fact that finding accurate information or getting access to accurate information about these companies is very difficult. And certainly for me, I've spent a lot of my kind of research career studying companies and using firm-level data. And getting access to good, accurate firm-level data on these companies is very challenging, for the simple reason that they are private companies. They're not publicly traded companies like pharmaceutical companies, which I've researched before, or big tech companies that you might hear about. And this means that they are not legally mandated to disclose the kind of information that we can get access about. And so even with the most expensive databases that University College London can get access to, I'm unfortunately unable to give you completely accurate figures about the scale of revenues in different areas. It's all based on, you know, kind of best guesses often, or information that's come from the companies themselves, which they don't need to disclose accurately. So what I'll do now, because I'm assuming that everyone has read the book, but just to refresh your memories, I'm going to just do a whistle-stop tour of some of the kind of core themes of the book, so that we're prepared for the discussion that we have with Resi imminently. So we spend a couple chapters of the book exploring the origins of this sector, which is fascinating, and we point to some great works by business historians and other people who have researched the history of the consulting industry and its development and its growth in the post-war years in North America and Europe, with the emergence of welfare states and the Second World War itself, which particularly in government, you know, created demand for people who had or were perceived as having logistics expertise and knowledge that existed in business. And then as the multi-divisional firms spread across Europe, again, demand for knowledge or insights about different markets came from these companies, and the consulting industry and a few firms in particular, including McKinsey and Company, positioned themselves well in order to be able to fill these markets. We do look in the book, we focus in the book, and it's not surprising given our kind of research background and Mariana's research background, we focus in the book on the role of these companies in governments. And one of the things that we look at is this argument that we see in academic research, and which might be quite intuitive to those of you who've been following politics and political economy over some decades, which is that the growth of these companies and their entrenchment in governments really can be dated back to governments that we might describe as neoliberal or having introduced neoliberal reforms. So in the UK, that would include Margaret Thatcher. Now, we find in the book, one of the things that we show is that during the Thatcher years, government spending on consulting did increase massively. So at the beginning of Thatcher's tenure, around in 1979, around £6 million was spent by the UK government on consulting services. And by the end of her tenure, that had increased to £246 million. We found similar statistics for the US, Canada, Australia, again, during their periods of economic reforms that included privatization and the introduction of competitive tendering into public services. Now, why was this? This was, you know, in many ways because the thing that these governments were looking for was introducing ideas and ways of implementing, ways of doing things, delivering things that were taking inspiration from business, and it was assumed, it was viewed that these companies were the best place to be able to help them deliver on these things, to help them privatise companies that had previously been in public hands, including the UK railways, including also, you know, state-owned enterprises in countries outside of Europe. We discuss in the book, for example, the role that many of these companies played in the privatization of banks in Mexico, or in the implementation of structural adjustment reforms in places such as Guinea-Bissau and Nigeria. So it's really not surprising. But a central argument that we do also make in the book is that they became entrenched, the role of these companies became entrenched, not really during this kind of neoliberal period within different countries, but actually in the period that came after, which has come to be known as the Third Way. So we had, for example, Tony Blair in the UK and Bill Clinton in the United States. And these were politicians who offered a very different vision of what the role of the state was in the economy, right? So they challenged the neoliberal politicians in terms of their vision. They said, hang on a second, you know, the role of the state is not to get out of the way, but actually it has an important role to play in determining what direction society should be moving towards, where production should be going, what values we have as an economy. But the role of the state should not be to produce these things if it is cheaper and more effective and efficient to do it in the private sector. So this was captured in this mantra that government should steer but not row. Now, one thing that we do in the book is really interrogate this, and we find a central argument in the book is that this way of doing government, this idea that governments can steer without doing rowing, without, you know, delivering services themselves, without developing policies, without recruiting experts within the public sector, and instead over-relying on the consulting industry. What we show, drawing on, again, insights from innovation economics and ideas around learning by doing, is that the consequence of this is that government ministries in particular, but also businesses, but government ministries can lose the ability to do things because they stop learning by doing when they become over-reliant on external consultants or other forms of expertise, other forms of outsourcing. So we argue that actually this form of government that is captured in the mantra of steering but not rowing is at the heart of what a conservative peer described as the infantilization of the British public sector during the pandemic. And this was a conservative peer, Lord Theodore Agnew. He wrote that civil servants that were being deprived of the ability to take on the crunchy issues of the day because these were being handed over to private sector consultants, management consultants, and this was having the process, this in the process, this was infantilizing the public sector. So we interrogate that argument we provide kind of evidence from also, again, innovation economics and studies of firms that show that, you know, if a company outsources at scale and scope, and if it outsources its ability, it loses the ability to learn endogenously. So it loses the ability to learn how to do things itself. We also, in the book, look at some of the consequences of this, of an over-reliance or a use of consultancies at scale and scope for democracy and accountability. And I won't spend too much time talking about this now because, as I knew it would happen, I'm running out of time. But these are serious issues, particularly in climate consulting, for example, where it has been pointed out that many of these large companies that are advising governments on how to achieve net zero are also simultaneously working for companies that are central or are the main emitters in our economies. And for example, in Australia, regardless of whether there was a genuine conflict of interest in the advice that McKinsey was giving to the Australian government when it was doing the analysis underpinning this long-term emissions reduction plan, commentators started pointing out the fact that, hang on a second, McKinsey has also been advising 43 of the 100 biggest polluters. Could this be an issue for the type of advice that it's giving to governments? This is, of course, not just an issue, a potential issue in government, but also in business as well. And this is also just one thing that I will just touch on here is when we were doing interviews with consultants, and we spoke to many consultants from the Big Four and the Big Three, and also from smaller consultancies, both current and former consultancies at different consultants at different levels. One of the things that kept coming up time and time again with consultants who were primarily working in the private sector was them saying, look, I'm not there to actually, you know, offer real value. I'm there to legitimize a decision that has already been made by a chief executive. And they're trying to, you know, prove to their shareholders that they have made the right decision, or they've got an argument with another executive. And so they're bringing us in to kind of add weight to their argument. Now, you might think that that is kind of unimportant, and I would say that, you know, I'm probably less interested in the consequences of that for our economies overall than I am, you know, for thinking about what happens through processes of infantilization in government. But at the same time, we can probably all agree that it's a pretty bad waste of resources and not a particularly effective way to run governments. So I think we'll be talking a little bit about the growth of the sustainability consulting and climate consulting more generally, but just to, again, add a few statistics, because we weren't originally going to write a chapter about climate and sustainability consulting, not because we didn't think it was important, but simply because we didn't know how big it had become. And it was during the course of doing research on the sector, particularly when we were doing analysis of the recruitment materials that these companies were doing, where they were promising graduates, you will be at the forefront of the green transition if you join our company. You will be an ESG consultant, you know, which is a, if you don't know what ESG means, you're very lucky. A type of framework that is used by businesses to, in theory, hold themselves to account, or by markets to hold themselves to account to deliver on emissions reduction goals and kind of gender equality goals. The problem with it, I wasn't going to talk about it now, but I will. If I start, I won't stop. But the problem with this kind of form of doing governance within companies is that it is premised on quite a narrow form of economics, right? This idea that if we all have the right type of information about all of these different companies, then, you know, consumption will be more responsible because people want to save the planet. It's in everyone's interest. Investors will invest more responsibly because investors don't want to invest in companies that are not doing anything to reduce their emissions or you know, that have no women on the board or whatever. But the problem with this kind of mode of doing governance, you know, disclosure of emissions can be a very good thing, right? And I think it is a very good thing. I think it's necessary for the green transition. We need to know what companies are doing and how much they're emitting and governments. But the problem with how this has been done is that there has been no standardization of these frameworks, right? So in 2019, one estimate was that there were 700 different ESG frameworks in play in the UK. Now, if the premise of an ESG kind of mode of governance is that we're supposed to be able to compare between different companies, and you have 700 different frameworks in play, you simply cannot compare between the companies because there's no standardization. Now, we talk about this in the book because the big three and the big four, particularly the big four, have been among the most prolific developers and promoters of these frameworks. And the big question that we ask, and that I hope we'll talk about in a minute, is why is it now that we have seen a huge proliferation of various forms of self-regulation, including of ESG frameworks within the sector? Why has the market for climate consulting grown so massively? We say $8 billion US dollars in the book, but a more recent statistic or more recent figure that we think is more accurate that I found with another colleague is $45 billion US dollars globally annually. Why is it now? Why was it in only 2021, given that there has been scientific consensus on the climate crisis, that many of these companies are establishing their sustainability division? So McKinsey established McKinsey Sustainability, BCG established the Center for Climate Action. Why is it now that they're acquiring smaller specialist climate and sustainability consultancies at scale and scope? Why is it now that the Conference of Parties of the UNFCCC had its first consulting partner? So the conclusion that we come to is that it is because we are now at this time of likely systemic action by governments, where governments are likely to be adopting more stringent regulations, that we are seeing increasing demand from companies that has become a source of resistance to this increased direct regulation by governments. And there are many precedents for this that we see in the consulting industry that we also talk about in the book. So I haven't really talked about the solutions that we also propose, and hopefully we can talk a bit more about them in the Q&A, but very, very quickly, I'll just run through them, starting with the kind of easy one, which is that certainly within governments, we need to increase transparency of who governments are working with and how. This is probably also true in businesses. And we need to demystify the ways that consultancies are used in our economies and why they're used. We need to improve our forms of procurement. So in government, we need better ways, or we often need better ways, we need more accurate ways of knowing who we are working with. Civil servants need to be capable to make assessments about the kinds of claims that are being made in tenders. So the big companies have whole divisions dedicated to bidding on contracts, and that can distort the market for tenders. And there are ways of developing contracts that more kind of accurately or more effectively embed learning within contracts to ensure that the knowledge that is developed through delivering a contract when government needs to use a third party is then brought back into the public sector. We also argue that fundamentally all of this requires more investment in public sector capabilities. So this is not a case of governments necessarily spending more. We know that actually, as we've documented in the book, governments are often wasting money when they are spending money on consultancies. So it's not, you know, big government versus small government, which has been brought up so much whenever I'm when we've been talking to actors in the United States about this book. They're just like, oh, you're communists and you just want big government. Frankly, that's not accurate. And what we need is better government, right? There is huge money being wasted. We just need to spend it better. And this can happen through, for example, developing in-house public sector consultancies. We know this is working in some places. It also requires investing in capabilities within ministries and ensuring that public sector jobs are good and people want to stay there. The big picture challenge is fundamentally we need to transform how we think about the role of government in the economy. We need a government that rows so that it's able to steer, so that it's able to do things like shape, guide our economies out of the climate climate crisis and towards a type of economy that works in the interests of the people that governments are representing. Thank you.
Wow, I mean, that was a marathon through your book. I'm really impressed. I know myself that reading the book, many questions came up, many discussion points came up that, of course, we won't be able to touch on extensively. I'm glad you brought up a lot of the sustainability angle. Of course, being an ecological economist, the topic of the socio-ecological transition is also at the heart of my work and our institute's work. And I have to say that thinking about the influence of the consulting industry was definitely not on the forefront of my research, as you know. So it's been very refreshing. And I would say, to a certain extent, it was also thinking about this systemic crisis that we are in today from the perspective of the consulting industry has been a very interesting and insightful perspective to it, right? I mean, I have many questions that we will not get through. And I will start with the title of the book, The Big Con. You describe the concept, maybe you can get into it a little bit more now. What is the big con that you address? And I would follow it up with the question, is there actually no real value to their work? So cross-organizational learning, for instance, is there no actual value that the consulting industry can provide?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. So the big con, obviously controversial title, as we well know. We stand by it though, because what we argue is that the scale and scope that this sector exists on in no way represents the value that it is creating for our economies. And to understand why and how it exists on this scale and scope, we have to understand broader structures in the economy. We also have to understand the types of things that the companies do. We do touch, I didn't talk about them in the in my presentation, but we do also discuss in the book strategies that companies have done historically that include, for example, recruiting from elite universities. Christopher D. McKenna, who was a historian of the consulting industry based at Oxford University in the UK, wrote about how even in the 1960s, because consulting was not a regulated profession, it didn't have the kind of legitimacy of professions like law or auditing. And so in order to create the legitimation, or in order to legitimate the profession, the companies adopted a strategy of recruiting, for example, Baker Scholars, who were the top 0.5% of students at Harvard Business School, of recruiting from Oxford University. We also write in the book about other kind of strategies that they use. And we argue that fundamentally, what is at the heart of the ability to extract value that is beyond the level, the scale of the value that is created through consulting contracts at a macro level, is a skewed risk-reward relationship. And just bear with me a minute, because this is where it becomes have my economist hat on a little bit, because we describe the value, or much of the value, that the consulting industry is able to earn, the revenues that it earns, as a form of rents, because we say that the ability, it is premised, or contracts are premised on the shifting of risk of failure away from the consulting company itself towards the client. And that's usually built into contracts, particularly in very large government contracts where no company would bid on them if that wasn't the case. And the consulting companies themselves enjoy a monopoly in our economies and our societies as objective sources of expertise, as objective sources of knowledge that no other company enjoys. And therefore, we describe the way that they earn this income as a source of rents. So that's why we describe it as a big con, because at the level of the economy as a whole, we see that more value is extracted than is created. That said, of course, you can point to instances where, you know, consulting contracts have gone very well. You know, I have friends who work in the consulting industry, and I can tell you that, you know, sometimes that they, at least to my face, they agree with the analysis, but they can also point to instances where they feel they have, you know, created value. And, you know, if you want, we don't go into too much detail about that in the book, but if you want to read about cases that have gone well, you can check out the websites of the companies themselves. That's what I always say.
Well, I mean, not to linger on this topic too much, but as it is at the heart of the topic, of the discussion today, I still wonder how you would really assess the value mm-hmm. that consulting, specifically management consulting firms, generate, because many of these firms, many of these services that they provide will not be monetary primarily, right? There will be tacit gains mm-hmm. and long-term gains. So really assessing this value, to me, seems a bit difficult, mm-hmm. but I think it's necessary if you talk about a discrepancy between the value they generate and what they charge, because mm-hmm. that generates the rent, right?
Yeah.
So how do you really make that statement? Do you need to have an idea of the actual value they generate, don't you?
So I think the default assumption, or the default argument, which is the one that we challenge in the book, the default idea about the consulting industry is that it exists on the scale and scope that it does today because it is able to create value for companies, is able to create economies of scale and knowledge. That's at the heart of it. So, you know, and that can include, for example, because these companies are working with lots of other companies in the economy, and therefore that is a source of knowledge that they have. If we take that as the kind of existing dominant argument, what we do in the book is try to unpick that and show that actually there are other ways of looking at this. And, you know, the way that we look at it suggests that they are not creating value on anywhere like the scale and scope that they exist on. Now, we can get into a full debate about value theory and how do we measure what is valuable in our societies, and I would welcome that. And I think, you know, this to be honest then points to bigger questions of how do we know, or how can we measure that when governments are working with other partners, that they are working with them in such a way that can best ensure that the interests that the government is trying to pursue, which in theory at least, you know, if we believe in representative democracy, in theory should be representative of what people want of their economy, how do we ensure that governments are actually working in this way? And that's why one of the things that we call for in the book is this increasing transparency of the clients that that consulting companies have, so that civil servants are able to at least understand and try to mitigate the risk of conflicting interest in this work, and if that is not possible, decide not to work with the company. At least in government, that's how I think it works.
To pick up on this topic of the outsourced risk, or maybe I guess I can maybe build a bridge to moral hazard that you talk about. You, if I remember correctly, say we overlook the moral hazard attached to these kind of contracts between government and big consultancy firms. But isn't that kind of the situation in any transaction that involves a third party contractor? Like, I think about maybe because it's close to my everyday life these days, homeowners and refurbishment projects. If I, as a lay woman, want to have my house refurbished to adhere to climate standards, I have no alternative but to trust that the advice that I am paying for by my architect is in my interest, that the prices that he gives me are accurate or plausible, and I don't have no way of proving or testing for this. Isn't that the same situation?
In all of these examples, this risk can be minimized and mitigated, right? So it may well exist in a range of different areas, you know. So it exists with whomever governments work with to an extent. But we've seen, for example, we look in the book at the history of accounting companies and legal companies and how they were structured and where the partnership structure that underpins many of these companies came from. And it was precisely to try to reduce the risk of conflicting interests, right? So the idea of a partner-based company is that the partner of a company, in theory, would be taking the risk of the advice that they're giving to their kind of legal client or their auditing client or the person they're keeping books for. They would accept some of the risk of that going wrong. Now, the problem, and in the United States, by the way, there is legislation that exists, for example, to separate the ability of consulting companies that also do auditing to provide auditing services and also provide consulting advice. And this came in the wake of the Enron scandal, where it was concluded, and it was kind of legally dropped, you know, criminal charges were brought, but it was concluded that the company that had provided auditing services, which was also receiving kind of huge contracts for consulting services, was underpinned by a conflict of interest that wasn't possible to mitigate it because this conflicting interest was too big. And so they introduced legislation to separate those two things. So I think you're right that this risk exists everywhere. But, you know, a big difference is that in the case of if you have a plumber in to fix your toilet and suddenly you can't flush your toilet, then that plumber's going to get a bad reputation, and through one way or another, through word of mouth, you're certainly not going to hire them again. This isn't true in the consulting industry. We know that that consulting companies continuously fail on government projects, and it doesn't affect their reputation, which is why we delve into this question of, you know, why that might be. Why do they enjoy this kind of unique ability in our economies? And how can governments try to mitigate that risk?
So probably more of a way of sanctioning their reputations would go far away there.
I think, yeah, sanctioning their reputations, it's more a case of protecting, recognizing that these conflicts of interest exist, and sometimes they might be unsurmountable, right?
Sure.
And often that isn't taken into account when governments are contracting these companies.
Because I've been informed that time is scarce, once again, I'll skip ahead a bit. I was wondering, I think largely during the book, throughout the book, that I have a bit of an issue with the causality claim.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, you are... You're blaming, or very strongly, it seems like you're blaming the consulting industry for the situation that we are in today, that governments are as hollowed out as they are, or infantilized as they are, and they seem to be the villains and the perpetrators. And I think you stress that it may come across this way. It really does come across this way. So I wonder if that causality claim isn't a bit far-fetched, and if we shouldn't consider that capitalists and firm owners and managers would have looked for cost-saving and productivity-enhancing measures even without consultancy firms. I mean, the idea that these ideas that have been prominently applied, Taylorism, cost accounting, and et cetera, if they have turned out to be productivity-enhancing in one company, I'm sure other companies would have found ways to access this strategy even without consultants.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, can we really be blaming the consultant? Or isn't the blame to be found more on a capitalist systemic level?
Yeah, certainly it can. I think we do argue that. You know, I would disagree with your interpretation. Obviously, that's very easy to say when you've written the book. I mean, we do say in the book that the big con is about a relationship fundamentally, and this is what is a book about: the political economy of the consulting industry. What we say about the function that the sector has played, you know, we write throughout the book that the consulting industry has ridden the waves of capitalism. It has grown, and it has simultaneously enabled and also helped to entrench and promote forms of capitalism that have been extractive, mm-hmm. Including, you know, the shift towards shareholder value orientation within companies that has led to chronic underinvestment in, firms, as you know, that are technologically or historically were technologically innovative. And other forms of governance and other structures in our economy that are widely criticised. I think we were interested in the sector in particular, not because we felt that it had a more significant role than, for example, asset management companies, right? Which I think we can agree have been playing an increasingly structural, systemic role in our economies. But they've also received a lot of attention and a lot of critique from the academic community over the past few years. We felt that the role of the consulting industry in these transformations in capitalism and in our economies had not received mm-hmm. The type of attention that these mm-hmm. other companies had done.
I agree. That's why I also found it very refreshing, like I said in the opening statement. I would even go as far as to pinpoint the role of the consulting industry as a kind of apostles or messengers, or I've read the term evangelists of these neoliberal or new public finance, public management ideas. But they don't come up with these ideas themselves.
They sometimes do.
They might, sure, I can't speak for all firms, but let's say that a lot of these ideas stem from other thinkers and very prominently, of course, economics and business school faculties. No? Mm. So the question is rather, shouldn't we also be looking at what is being taught at in universities? You yourself are an heterodox economist, I would say. So you know what is being taught at these institutes and how difficult it is to break convention, break paradigms mm-hmm. in these schools, right? But shouldn't we be also targeting them more than we are in your, like, personally, I would have said not, they haven't really been subject enough in your book.
Yeah, I agree. I think they should be interrogated. I would also say, though, you know, the management consulting, and you know, if we talk about the promotion of ideas and the spread of ideas, academia has been, sometimes I think within academia we can pay or we can exaggerate the extent to which economic ideas within the walls of the university are the biggest problem in our economies, right? Because actually, you know, the consulting industry throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s was publishing more business, more economics books that were read by mass audiences than anyone, than academia, right? So the best-selling management books of all time were written by management consultants from McKinsey. Mm. So I disagree with this. I certainly think that curricula, what is taught in universities, how we understand economics, is critical in and has been a critical force in shaping our economies and our understanding of our economies. But it is by no means not the only one. And I think we've just wanted to highlight another critical way that they have been shaped. And I would say, you know, arguably more important.
Well, it's interesting. You actually have a whole section dedicated to this topic of quasi-academia,
yes,
right, you call
yeah.
it. It would probably, be an interesting to scrutinize this a bit more. Mm-hmm. Like you said, there's a vast, vast, vast volume of literature coming from these quasi-academic institutions, from McKinsey, etc. But as opposed to really academic work, they're not being screened. Right?
Yes, yeah, it's not peer reviewed, yeah.
At all?
No.
So what is really effectively happening is that experiential knowledge, tacit knowledge, is being kind of framed to be academic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think some of it, so actually I will correct myself because some McKinsey Global Institute papers will have begun as academic peer-reviewed journal articles, for example. They also fund academic research. So this is something that, you know, when you, I guess when you finish a book, you always think of, oh, I wish we'd written more about this. So one thing that I wish that we'd touched a little bit more on is the links between academics and academics, not just universities and academia, but academics who are brought in to work in consultancies, for example, and help to create this. And we do talk about, as you say, these quasi-academic institutions. So there's Deloitte University, which is not a university. It's a campus where people who work for Deloitte can kind of go and get some in-house qualifications. There's also Capgemini University and other institutions, and McKinsey Global Institute, which again is, epitomizes some of these challenges because it does produce super interesting and valuable work. If you study markets, you probably will be using these reports or coming across them, but they play a different function. They play another function on top of this, right? Which is creating the perception that these are serious academic institutions when they're not.
Yeah. So I've been informed that time is basically up. I'm afraid. I'm very sad. There's so much more to touch on to. But maybe I can ask you for a bit of a closing statement, and in the course of that, maybe also tie it to the sustainability challenges that we are facing now and what role we could expect from the consulting industry to play.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much. Closing statement. So I think we when we wrote this chapter on the climate and sustainability consulting, one thing that I will close on is, you know, governments mostly do not know what they're doing when it comes to coordinating green transition. So my own kind of PhD and academic research is looking at how governments are trying to develop these capabilities for governing, for coordinating these systemic changes that are now mandated in legislation. This presents a challenge because if governments don't know how to do something, then they need to work with other people in order to be able to do it, right? So it raises challenges around how, or raises the question of how do governments work with other actors in this systemically important challenge in order to develop this kind of governing capability, these competences in ways that mean that these kind of endogenous learning processes are then developed within governments themselves. That means that they do need to work with consultants. We conclude the book by arguing that we probably need to expand our definition of what a consultant actually is, so that governments, when they are facing challenges, are not just automatically thinking, well, I'll go to one of the big three or the big four, but are looking then also to, and I do not work as a consultant, this isn't a plug, but they are concluding, but they are working with experts who have genuine knowledge, have genuine expertise that are then able to help them develop these capabilities internally.
Yeah. Great. Well, I guess I can just hope that the few hands that were raised before about pursuing a career in the consulting industry may reconsider and consider a job in the public services instead. Thank you so much for your attention. Rosie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And with that.
Thank you.